Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from our super secret bunker, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 95 of Registry Matters. I also forgot to say it's FYP Studios even. How are you this afternoon? No, it's not even afternoon yet. It's 11 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday.
That is correct. And it's a hot Saturday in Hotlanta.
It's not going to be that. It's not going to be as hot as it was yesterday. It was, I think my phone said it was 101 yesterday with the heat index. I'm a little bit further south than the super secret underground bunker. But today it's only supposed to be in the low 90s. How about that?
It's amazing. They've been setting records here that go back to 1911. And having lived around here and knowing that this is typically fall weather and going to the fairgrounds would be typically with a light jacket, and there was no need for jackets last night or any night this week.
Okay. Do you want to, let's see, we should jump right in. We got a short time schedule that we have to work through. We did get a new patron. I totally forgot to mention this last week, but it's from new patron John. So welcome aboard. Thank you very much. And then I just need to throw this out there that Justin, you are incredibly generous and thank you. And you increased your contribution. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Larry, please say some kind words for Justin.
I don't know how to respond to his generosity. I hope that whatever we're doing, that we're doing it for a lot of people, and the service we're providing, we intend it to be beneficial, and apparently it is to some, but thank you so much for your warm support. It's certainly a love offering.
We then also, from our episode last week, we received some feedback on the episode. And first off, Will in Tennessee says, wow, Larry brought the showerhead. Love it. My LG Rebel only has 8 gigabytes. So he's in the same boat as you are, Larry.
Well, that was adequate until last week.
He also says, move over, Larry. I need room in the underpowered smartphone boat. Thomas also wrote in. He said, in response to Will's comment or question, he says, such friendly young people. Ah, he caught the FYP in there. But that's not what FYP stands for.
What does it stand for?
It means, let's see.
Oh, I don't think we can say that on a family program.
Yeah, but you could just say, you know, figure out what the F is, and it's just you people. We had an episode, what, 2 or 3 episodes ago that talked almost entirely about what happens when the people come. Oh, it was the, what was it, like the New Jersey or was it New York? The community supervision people, whatever, like the local nonprofit, the Citizens for Megan's Law were coming around knocking on doors.
Yes. And where if you answer the door, my position is anyone has the right to knock at your door. But unless the statute compels you to respond, anyone has the right to ignore who's at their door and to answer the door and be non-cooperative. Now, I'm not recommending that, but I'm just telling you that that right does exist in the United States of America unless there's a statute that requires you to be cooperative. And that statute may be vulnerable if there is such a statute, but you have an obligation to answer your door. In fact, I seldom ever answer my door.
Right. Just like I don't ever answer my phone because 99% of the time it's a scam call. It's a telemarketer calling.
I would tend to agree that the overwhelming majority, to me, getting rid of a person at the door is more difficult than getting rid of the phone call. There's a little button you can press that ends the call. I haven't discovered a button yet that'll end the confrontation at the door. Now, you certainly can close the door, provided you have something between you and the person where they can't put their foot in the way and where they can't shove their way in. But to me, it's just so much easier to disengage an unwanted call than it is to disengage an unwanted door knock.
I would completely agree with that. And then finally, David says, Larry, I think you need a slightly more capable phone.
Well, I do. I doubled this week.
Oh, you doubled? You have now 16 gigaschmitzels?
I sure do.
Man, that's fantastic.
And I even installed Zelle on my phone.
What are you going to do with Zelle?
Just in case I need to transfer money.
Uh-huh. That's, all right. Sounds sketchy. Sounds sketchy.
Well, I thought that was a pretty efficient movement of funds.
It is, definitely a more efficient way of moving funds around. It's it's owned by PayPal. To me, it's the same thing. I don't get what the difference is.
Well, I was told that it's far more secure than PayPal.
I've never heard of a breach from PayPal. I'm sure that it has happened. I've just never heard of any sort of large scale. The only thing that PayPal has is a bad reputation because people used their name to send out phishing email messages.
Mm-hmm.
But, all right, well, then let's move on. We just received some breaking news. Did you get this one today from Nebraska, or did you get this yesterday?
It came today, but I think as a result of this last few days, they had some hearings in Nebraska and the legislature, I guess, in some interim committees they have.
So the article's dated from yesterday, but it's Nebraska sex offenders testify for changes in registry law. I didn't get a chance to read a whole lot of it because you sent it to me like 10 minutes ago.
Well, I got it 15 minutes ago.
Did you read it?
I did read it.
All right.
So it appears as though the Nebraska legislature has interim committees similar to what we have, and that the Judiciary Committee, which, remember, they only have one chamber. They don't have a bicameral. They have a unicameral. So they have just one body. And it looks like the Judiciary Committee held hearings on the Nebraska registry and ways to improve it. And the gist of the article, the way I read it, was that a large number of people testified, some offenders and some family members, in regards to how the 2009 law has made their life more difficult. And so the chair, Lathrop, is very much interested in if they need to make improvements to the law. Now, whether he can achieve that is another matter, because you've got 49 senators over there. So that means, A, you have to get it to the floor through the committee. And I forget the number on the committee if there's a bill, but then you have to get a majority of the 49, and you have to get the executive signature. It says 28 people who were registered, and their family members, brothers, sisters, spouses were there.
I think we've talked about this before, but what do you think the impact is of, we've punished the sex offenders, but what about the families that get punished? What do you think the impact of them testifying before the politicians is?
Far more powerful and persuasive. Something I've been hoping to see more of for a long time. And I'm glad that they did it. I'm impressed. I didn't get to see it. They sent me a link so I could have watched it live, but since I'm on this trip, I wasn't able to set aside that block of time to watch it live. But it's very, very powerful. I'm sure that they had some moving stories, because I've heard some of those stories from Nebraska, and they would be the same in any states, just that I spent more time a few years ago working with them, and I heard some of their stories of how their life was. Nebraska had a risk-based system prior to 2009, and in 2009 they changed it to an offense-based system. And under the risk-based system, the majority of the people were not on the internet. Now, under their offense-based system, everybody's on the internet, and for much longer periods of time as well. The previous system was 10 years, unless you had more than one conviction, and now they went to the modeled after the federal system. That was what they were hoping to do, was to get their precious compliance designation. So they modeled themselves after the federal system, but they didn't do a very good job of it in some regards, because they didn't give the 5 years on the tier one they could have given for reduction in time. And some of the offenses were tiered incorrectly. They didn't have to be in tier three. But as long as you at least do the minimum, that's what people have trouble grasping, is that the state can over-tier, but that's not a problem. And they say, well, I don't have to be a tier three, and Nebraska's got me at tier three. Well, that's true. You don't have to be. But Nebraska doesn't get penalized for having you over-tiered. They get penalized for having you under-tiered.
So the argument would then, well, you should have thought about that before you committed your sexual offense. And, I mean, shouldn't we hold people accountable for their decisions? Even that, I mean, using your family as some sort of collateral consequence, I mean, that seems to be a legit leverage point to get people to act right.
Well, it assumes that the registry is intended to punish. We do hold people accountable for the consequences, and they do suffer consequences, but those consequences are not a part of the civil regulatory scheme. The punishment was the imprisonment or the intensely supervised probation. and the felony conviction, the punishment of the registry, which is not supposed to be punishment, even if you could make the argument that you should be able to punish people through a civil regulatory scheme, you're not entitled to punish the family. And beyond that, how would you be able to imagine, since it's a civil regulatory scheme and they can change it at will, assuming that you do think of it in advance, assuming there's no impulse behavior that causes someone to act in an aberrational fashion and commit a sexual offense that's out of character for them, how would you be able to anticipate what type of outlandish and ridiculous changes that could be imposed and constantly moving goalposts so that you can never exit this regulatory scheme so that they can constantly escalate? How would a person be able to take that into consideration when the goalposts are constantly moving? I'd like to know the answer to that.
I was thinking more in like the very present sense, but then our super patron Mike, that, you know, he committed his offense 100 years ago. And he's still then dealing with all of that, even though he's no longer on any sort of supervision, but he still has the Florida garbage that he has to deal with.
Right. But I don't think Florida's always had all that garbage. I think Florida, like most states, has continually escalated the requirements. Thanks to our victims advocacy, they always seem to be able to be very persuasive in how you should be able to punish more people through the regulatory scheme. But assuming you do think in advance and you say, I'm thinking about committing a sexual offense. Let's see. Now, I may get 3 years in prison and I may get 5 years on probation. I can hack that. But how would you be able to anticipate an ever-changing landscape in terms of the additional pylons? How could you take that into consideration? Some of the comments on this article say that they should have thought about that. How would you be able to anticipate what the ever-changing requirements would be? That's what I don't understand. Assuming that people do think in advance and that they should think in advance, how would you be able to do that?
Yeah, I like I said, I could see something more in the immediate sense, but something that happened any degree of time, you know, especially after your sentence is done. But did Narsal have any involvement in this whole this showing?
Well, I'm not even sure of the affiliation status of Nebraskans Unafraid, but I know it was organized by the showing was organized by a group called Nebraskans Unafraid. I'm not certain if they are affiliate or an advocate or how they're connected in Arsenal. It's kind of embarrassing that I don't know all that.
That's not even the question I'm asking. Brenda's saying that she's saying that they're all connected to Narsal, and Narsal submitted written testimony for that that hearing.
Oh yeah, I do recall that. Yeah, she can chime in here if she likes and tell us.
She just said she stepped away, so she can't do that at the very moment. But she wanted me to bring that up, that Narsal was involved with all that. And you being the spokesperson for Narsal, please chastise me for saying that.
I am not the spokesperson.
Well, we can then start moving on to different articles that we have. The first one is kind of interesting in that it's from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It's from WGAL. Lancaster mother sentenced to house arrest for bringing child to home of three registrants. And both of us are still scratching our heads. There's not nearly enough meat. I did a quick Google search to try and find any sort of more information about it. Is there a statute in Pennsylvania that says that you, as a free-reigning citizen, you can't bring your children to the home of a registrant? Therefore, you're committing the felony? That's very strange to me.
Apparently, that might be the case. It's not really clear to me that it. I mean, you in America, the person who's the non-convicted individual, which is the mom, they're not under any restraint. So theoretically, they can associate with whomever they choose. I thought that was one of the basic principles of American freedom and liberty. So therefore, you take your kid to visit where there happens to be a registered sex offender. In my mind, you wouldn't have been in violation of anything. Now, that doesn't hold true for the people that said there was at least two in that house under supervision. But what's not clear, it's kind of clear, but if the person named Johnson was under supervision or not, that person could be in violation of their conditions of supervision. But I didn't know that a person was forbidden to date or have any type of overnight or any visitation with a sex offender. I've not heard of that one. So this is going to be enlightening to us to figure this out, because a listener will be out there in Pennsylvania will tell us that, oh, no, you can't. If you're on the registry, a person can't have. How would they know that you're? How would you? Where would the knowledge come from?
It doesn't seem to be terribly different than someone goes to a bar and they interact with someone, and that someone turns out to be a minor, but you were at a bar where you needed to present legal ID to get in and all this of legal age, and then they turn out to be, you know, using a fake ID that you had no knowledge. That's strict liability, right?
That would be my definition of it. If you would have every reason to believe that the person in there is of legal age. So it would, assuming that the bar is doing its job, you wouldn't need to run a separate identification check. You're in this bar, but you may have gotten in here illegally. So you mind showing me your ID?
Right. So this feels similar, right?
It does feel very similar.
How could you be, and she apparently knew, I'm not trying to even make that case, but how would you know to not bring, you wouldn't necessarily be up on the laws. You could find out that the person is a registrant and you're like, okay, I have no idea what that means. So then you go open up the 400 pounds of law books and figure out, oh, wait, I can't bring my children around you because you're like, I can't see how that law would be enacted where everyone is now subjected to a code that they are completely unaware of and could violate just on a dime.
It seems very bizarre. Hopefully we'll unearth some more information on this. But the average person walking around, I thought in this country we gave the parents broad decision-making power to make the decisions because they know what's in the interest, best interest of their kid. We hear this all the time about family planning and stuff. We don't need the big old bad government telling us that their kids need to be taught sex education and stuff in school because the parents know what's best for the kids. It would seem like to me that a parent would, assuming that she did know in this case, I think she did know, wouldn't the parent be the best equipped according to conservative doctrine to decide who to have their relationship with? I don't understand why you'd want to put the big bad government in that decision making process.
And I'm gonna make some crazy assertion. I mean the I don't know how long it's been that way, but Pennsylvania is Republican controlled in the legislature.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Since we don't know enough about it, I wouldn't want to make that correlation. But in general, it is the conservatives who claim that they stand for lack of intrusion of government into family decision making. It would seem like this would be one of those areas where the family, like they say that they know the best for what's best for their kids. Maybe the mother had evaluated the offenses. Maybe the mother had concluded that this didn't pose any risk to her child. What makes the big bad government more qualified to make that decision and spend and prosecute this woman and spend a whole bunch of money? Because I thought the parents were best equipped to make decisions anyway.
No, that's clearly not. We need a government to oversight parents. So. All right. Well, then the next one comes from law.com, and this one is certainly off the beaten path a little bit, but White versus Louisiana, flawed memory and the confrontation clause. I guess that's part of the deal that we would want to cover. But it seems that this individual has a different account for what went down versus what the police say. And then somebody else says they don't remember. And one of the things that I got out of the article was that the judge didn't want to open up the floodgates for everyone to come in and go, I don't remember any of this stuff. Can you shed some light on what is going on in this article?
Well, it's not as complicated as the long article makes it out to be, and boy, it was a long read. So I'm probably the only one that reads it. The issue is that the person who did the shooting allegedly had a witness against him named Brandon Coleman, and he gave a statement to the police that he witnessed White do the killing, a videotape statement, and then he suffered a brain injury. So by the time White comes to court, he has no independent recollection of what he testified to, or what he made a statement. It was not testimony at that time, but he can't recollect his statement. He can't remember anything. So the judge decided to admit the statement anyway, because the judge said, well, if we allow people to make a statement at the police station and then magically have memory loss, he said, that's what everybody will do, that they will do that. So therefore, so the guy took the witness stand, Brandon Coleman took the witness stand, and he was at risk of being incriminated because he was an accessory to this crime, and he just couldn't remember anything. So they list the questions in the article that he was asked, and he just did not have any independent recollection. So then the question became, since there is a confrontation clause that the victim's advocates are trying so desperately to get rid of, the question was whether or not the confrontation clause was satisfied because he couldn't remember anything. Well, there's two trains of thought. He did show up for court. He was there. He did take the stand. He just couldn't remember anything. Well, does that satisfy the confrontation clause?
I can see that going both ways.
That's exactly why the appellate case law that they cited, it has gone both ways. He showed up for court. It's not like he was shielded from coming to court. He presented himself. He took the stand and he testified, and the defense attorneys could have asked him all the questions they wanted to ask him. He just couldn't remember anything, but he was not hiding from questions. He didn't say, I'll choose not to answer your questions on Fifth Amendment grounds. He said, I can't answer your question because I don't have any recollection.
And he did confirm in there, like, can you confirm that the person you see on the tape is so-and-so? Yes, I can confirm that, but I don't remember the event. I'm going to completely go down a different path. You've heard in the news about all the deep fakes where computers are able to analyze all of the syllables and they can create speech that was never said by a person.
I've heard of that.
Okay.
Yes.
So here it is. So you and I have done in 95 episodes of this podcast, we have probably enunciated every syllable and sound that we would ever make. Someone could then go catalog all this stuff and they could create a whole podcast and we never said anything. And we get up on the stand and so the prosecution goes, well, can you confirm that? Like, yeah, that sounds like me. That sounds like the things that I may have said, but I didn't say them. Well, how do you know? Like, I mean, yeah, you've planted something completely fabricated. And I'm taking it off track just to me, that's like where this goes, but you could totally not remember. You could also be lying your ass off, but you could totally not remember something happening or not even be aware that the thing occurred.
Well, that's what the trial judge was concerned about, that if he didn't rule the way he did, he was concerned that his court would become the laughingstock because everybody would just not remember anything.
Yeah.
And so even the strong advocate, Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court, he's even gone the other way. And I can't break out all the nuances because of the article was longer than what I can digest in the short prep time, but he's even said there are exceptions. If they grant certiorari, this is on, it's going to a conference. So it's going to be interesting to see. I was saying that this is in the petition for cert and going to a conference to see if they can find four justices who want to grant review. And there's interest in the case, even at this stage of the process, which normally due to the thousands of cert petitions, it's hard to get support until the court has ruled. As one of those catch-22s, there's 9,000 vehicles coming through to ride. No one has the resources to file a brief on 9,000 cases, so they wait until to see if the court's going to grant cert, and then they jump in. But this one's already got some interested parties at this early stage.
Do you have any sort of idea what direction you think things would go?
Well, I think it's very possible that they can get the four justices for the cert, but I have no idea where it's going to go if they decide to pick the case.
We could possibly assert that Gorsuch, being Scalia Jr., would be in favor of the confrontation clause side.
If he holds true to the aspect of his, Scalia was one of the best on confrontation.
Yeah.
He said, by golly, that's what it says and that's what it means. But see, this guy was there for confrontation. Is it whose fault is it that the defense attorneys didn't ask him any questions? I mean, they could have kept him on the stand for 14 hours and let him answer every single question saying, I don't remember.
That would be a lot of fun.
Well, but he presented himself for court, so he was confrontable. They chose not to confront him. My hunch is that if they grant cert, that this is going to satisfy the confrontation clause.
I don't see how you could get. I mean, unless you then hold the guy in contempt of court for not cooperating. But if
how could you hold a person in contempt that can't remember it until we can establish what you can remember?
Yeah. Could you bring in all the psychiatrists, psychologists, neuroscientists, everybody to validate whether the person does have some kind of traumatic brain injury that he can't remember things?
You could do that, but you still won't know what he remembers.
Yeah. And no, I'm with you until we get, like, you know, seeing into your brain technology. And boy, do I really not want that to happen. I really, really don't. I like having the thoughts in my head be mine.
I would imagine so. Particularly the thoughts that are in your head.
No doubt, no doubt, no doubt. All right. From the appeal, there's this Louisiana Gulf War veteran is serving life for selling $300 million. No, I'm sorry. It's $30 worth of marijuana. How do you get life in prison for selling 30 bucks a weed?
Well, you commit multiple crimes in the state of Louisiana that has a habitual offender statute that permits that, where the lawmakers have gifted the prosecution with that ability, and that's how it happens, and that's how it did happen.
Is he a drug dealer then?
Well, he was apparently dealing drugs. He sold $30 worth of marijuana. That would constitute a sale, wouldn't it?
I think if he sold it, I think that constitutes selling.
Right. Well, then he was dealing, and but if you give it away for free, is that dealing?
I still think it sounds like it's dealing.
That's certainly distributing.
Yeah, it's certainly that. Yeah. Where does the line get crossed? Is it if you charge one penny for what you're? God, maybe you should set up. You put a hat down and say donations taken, and you know. So you give somebody the weed for free, it's, you know, but hey, I will take donations. Then you're not selling.
So, well, but to succinctly answer the question, you get that result when you empower the establishment with those powers. And it sounded very good when they were passing the law. Now, you know, Louisiana's in the top. They either run number one, two, or three, depending on how the calendar is running in terms of the highest percentage of incarceration per 100,000. But the reason is if a prosecutor didn't have that power, they would not be able to exercise it. Now, would they?
They definitely would not.
Well, so how the result is that the prosecution had the power, and they sought habitual status, and it was granted. And so now he's whining about it. And there are people who find it to be unconscionable. But I would say it's unconscionable to you, the people of Louisiana, who made this law without sufficient thought and narrowing it. Say, we have a three strikes law in our state that'll put a person away for life. We drew it so narrowly, not a soul has ever been put away. And I think this was signed by Governor Johnson in 95, 96. Not a soul has ever been sent away for life.
And wait, tell me about Governor Johnson. What do you call him?
That would be Gary Puff Johnson.
the libertarian presidential candidate.
Yes, right? the one who had an amazing turnaround about marijuana. And he when he was elected first, he was the law and order governor. And when he ran for re-election, he was the law and order governor, promised that they would serve every stinking day. And then in his process of his second term, he matured and he came to the conclusion that we were spending too much money on prisons and incarcerating low-level drug offenders. And to his credit, he said he was wrong, that he realized that we didn't have a criminal problem. We had a prosecution problem, and we needed to decriminalize all these minor drugs, marijuana, and we needed to let people live their lives. And he had a complete turnabout. So I call him Puff just for kicks and giggles, but he did do an about face, and to his credit, he realized that he was wrong and said so. And that's exactly what we want people to do is to learn from from their life experience and who recognize when they were wrong, as I have been and will continue to be on things. As I gain more information, I'll look back and say, I thought I had it right on that. And now I think I see that I didn't have it right.
Let me travel down this path real quick. So that's an example of someone changing their mind. And then we, the people, will then go, oh, this politician flip-flops. Like, you can't hold them, like they can't update and change their way of thinking. And we beat them to death. But then we will also beat them to death on, can they ever evolve their thinking? You know, the whole crime thing with Hillary Clinton, the super predator and all that stuff. And, you know, people's attitudes evolve and change.
Well, I think from my personal perspective, I hold them accountable when they have oscillating views that change from audience to audience. I don't hold anyone in disdain for maturing and recognizing that they were wrong and they evolve in their thinking. But if you speak to one group and you're pro-life and you speak to the next group, you're pro-choice, that's the problem.
Okay.
But Gary Johnson has truly had an evolution in his thinking. Now, he's still the fiscal conservative. He vetoed everything, even things that Republicans sponsored, because he believed that government should be perpetually in shrink mode. That was his belief. He made no doubt about it. And he got elected president. He believes the federal government is anywhere from 20 to 40% too large. I disagree with him on that. I think it would be a cataclysmic. I think we would have a cataclysmic depression in this country if we were to shrink the federal government by 20 to 40%. I mean, it would send us into something we haven't seen since the Great Depression. But he at least is consistent with that view. He doesn't speak to one group and say we should shrink government by 20%, and then he's going to go to the next group and say we should grow government.
Okay.
But back to this article. What's interesting about this article, which makes it good for the appellate review that it's undergoing, is that he was the prosecution offered him a plea of 7 years. Now, in that original offer, they did not agree to take habitual off the table, but apparently the offer was not communicated to him. Then they made a subsequent offer to give him 10 years. And again, that it appears that his appellate lawyer now is saying that offer was not communicated to him. The U.S. Supreme Court said about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe so I think it was in 2012 or so, they ruled about plea offers. The prosecution has no duty to make you a plea offer, but a defense attorney does have a duty to communicate that offer. And if this offer was not communicated to him, and there was such an offer, then he has recourse on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I can't cite the case by name, but I can tell you there was two of them the same term, and they had to do with plea offers that were not communicated. And that was one of them, and the other one was, I think, dealt with a rejected offer. But there was two cases of the same term regarding pleas that U.S. Supreme Court decided, and this would fall squarely within that. His attorney had a duty. You can simply send your client an email. You can send them a letter. You can do something to the last known address. And the attorney said, his original trial attorney says, well, I lost contact with him. Well, maybe you did. But some method of communication should have been preserved. If you sent the mail saying the prosecutor has made you a 7-year offer, this is something you ought to look at and let me know. If that was not delivered, it should have been returned. And even if it was delivered, and you would at least have a record. Hopefully you keep records of correspondence. I'm hoping that our attorneys out there to represent people keep some level of diligence on what they're doing. You at least have a notation in your file, sent offer, and then 20 days later you go back because the offer was going to be withdrawn after 20 days, and you know it in the file, never heard anything from the client. At least you would do that much, I would hope.
I was just going to ask you, so when a plea offer gets presented, then to cover your own butt as the defense attorney, that you would then bring it to your client, and even if they decline it, then you have them sign something saying, hey, I showed you this, and you've declined it, not just verbal?
I wouldn't say you have to go through the steps of having them sign it, but certainly you need a document. Now, I know that they've got 127 cases open where they should have about a third that number. I understand that, but it's one of those things where you have to find the time to cover this, because the client come back and said that they never knew about the offer. They're sitting in life for prison now, where that might not have been the case had they taken the offer.
Yeah.
So when someone's life is at stake, you need to find time, I would think.
But I don't want to jump ahead too far, but one of the coming up articles is going to be about why we should fund the public defenders less. So that would be one way to help solve this problem, right?
Well, how would less work?
Because then they would be able to spend less time, and that would make it more efficient.
So Missouri versus Fry is coming to mind on one of the cases. So the gurus out there could search Missouri versus Fry. I'm actually not smart enough to open another window and do that, but that one came to my mind. And then there was another case that same term about plea offers that were made and what the Supreme Court decided. But you need to communicate the offer to your client, and your client gets to have the final say if they want to go to trial.
This next article is also from The Appeal, When Prosecutors Bury Police Lies. I am still over the top, just completely confused. And just to throw like a counterpoint on this, I was listening to the podcast Opening Arguments, where that attorney that we had on a couple months ago was on. And he says, he said, he knows a bunch of prosecutors, and he said they like lose sleep over the notion of putting an innocent person away and, you know, taking away somebody's liberty. And they want to make sure that they, when evidence is presented, that I'm trying to remember the clause that he used, the statement of it enacted a thing when there's evidence. And I can't remember what it was called at this point, but so how is it that prosecutors have evidence that could be exculpatory and they just like, we'll just put this over on the bottom of the filing cabinet and we just never find it. I just can't figure that one out.
Well, and that particular situation is slightly different than what they're talking about here. What they're talking about here is where a cop comes with an affidavit, and they raise their hand and they put it here before a judicial official, and they take out a warrant to go. They request a search warrant or an arrest warrant, and they swear to certain facts. Well, the prosecutor looks at that, and they say that couldn't have happened that way. They read the affidavit and they say it couldn't have happened that way. That's just not a credible story. But it puts the prosecutor in an awkward position, because the police union, even if it's not a police union, the brotherhood and camaraderie among police officers is very strong. And I can't explain it because I've not been there. I can only tell you that this is the reality of it being existence. When you're in the prosecutor's office, you have to work with police. You don't do your own investigations and arrest. So you're relying on, when that drug bust went down, you're relying on a team of officers from various ranks who put that case together, and you're reading reports written by multiple people. And some of those reports look like, wow, this wouldn't have happened that way. Then you're faced in an awkward position because your team is lying, and you know your team is lying. You know that that didn't happen that way because your life experience tells you that that couldn't be credible, that a person wouldn't have reacted that way. Well, that's what happened in this case. But you have a choice to tell that member of the team, sir, ma'am, your affidavit is just totally false, and you know that you lied in this affidavit. Or you have the choice, which happened in this case, you make a sweetheart deal offer, so that you don't have to put that person on the stand. And the cops rely on the sweetheart deal because of mandatory minimums. Mandatory minimums, which victims' advocates are so fond of promoting, that gives the leverage to the prosecution team, because if you roll the dice and you lose, you're going down for a mandatory amount of time. So the lying officer never has to testify. Well, the prosecution, when they look at those affidavits that were bogus, and they know they were bogus, they don't take any steps to do anything about it because it wasn't necessary. They got their conviction anyway.
And we know when we covered the Larry Krasner stuff that I don't remember the number, but it was some decent number of officers that were listed in some sort of book that couldn't be trusted. And I'm not sure if they got fired, but like, hey, we're never going to call on these officers to bring in testimony, which could then make the prosecution's case crumble. And in the opening paragraphs of this particular article, the police told a version of the story saying, oh, they saw a bulge in in Turnbull's is the person's name. They saw a bulge in his jacket. And then they find video surveillance and it completely contradicts their story. It could be the police just misrecollected, but if you have a history of it, they are trying so hard. The police are trying so hard to keep that information from getting out on their own internal, rating system of how reliable a particular officer is. Why don't we, the people, have access to know how trustworthy a particular cop is?
I wish I knew the answer to that, but I wish I knew the answer to one other question. I wish I knew the answer to, I'm assuming, because we've heard all our life, that the overwhelming majority of police officers are good, honest, hardworking. Right? You've heard that.
I have. You should trust them, and they're going to help you and rescue you, etc.
Well, I feel the same way about teachers. I feel that the overwhelming majority of them are good, hardworking people. I feel the same way about my colleagues when I worked in the grocery store. Majority of them were, not all of them, but the majority of them were good, hardworking people. What has always confused me is, since you're a good, hardworking person, why do you want to protect a not hardworking person who's not good? It befuddled me as a teenager why you would want to have dead weight around you and have people that dishonor the profession. So I'm confused as to why a police officer, seeing a colleague being dishonorable and writing a fictitious affidavit and going in and testifying untruthfully, it puzzles me as to why a police officer, since they're all overwhelmingly good, honest, decent people, do not want that bad apple out of the force. I wish a police officer could explain that to me, because I'm not able to process that.
This seems to be more like protect the team, protect the institution at the expense of the individuals, too.
Well, that's exactly it. I get the part that they're protecting the team. But to me, since I think I'm semi-rational and logical, I don't understand why you would want to protect a bad member of the team. Okay, let's say you're the Atlanta Falcons, and you've got a person who's out making the Falcons organization look bad. Would you want that member to be a Falcon, or would you want that person to be bad? Would you want the public to think all Falcons are that way, or would you want that person to be ousted so that the public doesn't think that all Falcons are that way?
Yeah, I do see your example, but you know, we could say this about political parties too. Is it, you know, there's some impeachment talking. Do you protect the institution of the presidency, or do you bring charges? I don't want to talk about the credibility of the charge. I don't want to talk about that. But do you do what you are like constitutionally mandated to do, or do you say the office is too respected to be challenged?
So, well, that would be a rabbit hole to go down, wouldn't
it? I know it would be, but that feels like, you know, a fairly close, fairly significant current level of news comparison.
Well, back to this article, though, the prosecutors do not challenge the police establishment because they need them. And most of these cases resolve themselves 95% with pleas, and therefore it's just, it doesn't need to be dealt with as far as they're concerned.
Just one other thing is, would it be possible to separate out that prosecutors are not, like, you know, quote unquote, related to the police? Could it be a three-legged system, sort of like the way the government is set up in general, to where they're their own independent organization, you know, and not tied? I don't know. I don't know if I'm communicating that well. It just seems like an idea, so that they're more impartial to where they're getting their evidence from also.
Well, but somebody has to be the ground troopers, and that's the law enforcement. That's the cops, the beat cops. Somebody has to be out there grabbing bad guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to see if there's a way to set up some sort of barrier to create, you know, almost like having so this particular county, they use that particular county's sheriff's office, you know, law enforcement to do the investigating, but then have prosecutors from a completely different area so that they're at least more independent than having the local.
Now, that's an interesting theory. So they would not be tied at the hip under that
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talk about attorneys, you know, you would want one that can grease the wheels for you. You would want for something that you're trying to get almost like a favor. If you're trying to get a petition to get off the registry, you would want the well-connected lawyer and all that. But if you're going to bring some sort of controversial thing, you would want to get the out-of-town lawyer so that they don't lose their political, whatever the words are, their, you know, their political ties, and they don't burn any bridges by bringing some controversial case.
So the Butts County, where we're sitting now, their cases would be prosecuted by someone who's not directly connected to Butts County. They would just take a total independent look at the evidence.
Even like a random drawing, and you move the case. I don't know. Just something that I was thinking just now.
Well, so you would have like roving prosecuting tribunals that would not be so closely tied at the hip.
Right.
So somebody from Catoosa County would be prosecuting this case here, and they would say, sorry, this just doesn't add up. Therefore, you've got no case.
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't think it's the worst thing I've ever heard. It's kind of like professional jurors.
Yes.
Because we have such high level of complexity and forensics evidence today that we didn't have even 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
And the jurors are just overwhelmed with experts now. Overwhelmed. If you were to sit through a trial today, if on the off chance that it involves even the most basic of forensics, the experts are just mind-boggling in terms of what they testify to.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. Now, after that rabbit hole, let's move back over to law.com. You know, reading just the title of this, and it just says public defender counsel would furlough staff to meet government budget cut mandate, a governor's budget mandate, cut mandate. And reading through it, hey, this is in the fine state of Georgia, where they want to it's a Kemp, our wonderful, who wants to drive around in his own pickup truck and pick up the brown people. He wants to go around. He wants all agencies to cut 4% from their next year's budget, including to the public defenders, but not including, I think it's at the law enforcement and then also prosecutors. So we want to prosecute more people, but we want to give them less defense.
Why is that a problem?
No. All right. Let's move on.
So, yes. Well, what's interesting about this, and I think it ties into another article. First of all, knowing a little bit about how well-funded states are, Georgia is one of the best financed states in the country in terms of having a very diverse economy, having very reliable revenue streams, and having predictable revenue flows. So I don't know what's driving the request for the budget cuts. I mean, this is supposed to be the best economy that we're in the history of all of mankind, and so revenue should be just gushing in, particularly in a diversified state like this. So I don't know what's driving the four. I haven't been in tune with the local politics well enough to know, but it says in the article that public defenders opened 144,224 new cases in 2019, fiscal year 2019, which was a 20% increase over fiscal year 2017. Now, all that's under the booming economy of this administration. And yet, the number of cases have gone up by 20% in a very brief period of time. That's 10% per year, right?
Yep.
Well, I mean, mathematically, it's actually a little bit different because of the compounding, but 10% per year. In a booming economy, that tells us a couple of things. It tells us that either the booming economy is not having any direct correlation with the people who are committing economic crimes, or it tells us that they have so well funded the police and law enforcement apparatus, which is apparently what this article is alluding to, because they don't suffer any cuts. It tells me that they're able to pump in more and more cases into the system. That's what I'm reading between the lines here.
Yeah, and something that you've brought up on a number of cases is the three-legged stool that I just mentioned, but from a different point of view, that you have judges, they don't control the caseload. Prosecutors, they control the caseload, but public defenders, I guess judges do control to a degree, but the defense attorneys, they don't control the caseload at all. And so now we're going to fund them less. Is that going to make the system more efficient or less efficient?
Well, if you believe that due process is irrelevant, then it'll make it more efficient, because if you have fewer defense attorneys, it'll just mean more and more cases are resolved by last minute plea deals where they've never seen their attorney before, and they tell them this is the best they can do. But in terms of the three-legged stool, the judges actually do control cases. Judges are part of the initiation of cases in most jurisdictions. They have to sign off on some level of probable cause. And then the judges have control over making sure the rules are followed and deadlines are met and timelines are adhered to, and they grant extensions and exceptions to the rules. They have some control. Defense attorneys have only one mechanism to reduce their caseload, and that's to do what? To plead out the case.
Right.
Yes. So the prosecutor has a lot of discretion, because they can choose and prioritize and say, we don't prosecute that in this district. That's like, for example, in Boulder, you'd never get a prosecution for drug possession. They just flat out wouldn't bring it, because if they did, no jury in Boulder would ever convict anybody of a simple drug possession. So they just simply don't file them. And prosecutors have that type of discretion. And in fact, now that Colorado is a legalized state, I don't think you would have whatever the legal limit is if you had less than that. But even if you had slightly more than that, they would not prosecute that in Boulder, because no jury would convict anybody.
Yeah.
I would say that would be the case down here in Houston County, Georgia. I bet a jury would convict someone of possession here.
I've talked about before, it was right before I got out, the legislature was considering legalizing. I want to say that they even like watered it down to where it was just the CBD oil. It has since been legalized, but you got this father who's testifying saying, this is the only thing that helps my kid who has hundreds of seizures per day. So what you're telling me that I have to do is go to Colorado where I can get it, or California, some other place where I can get it. And you want me to package it in such a way that I can transport it on a plane. And you want me to travel across state lines with this illegal substance so that I can keep my kid from having seizures. And I can't fathom how the legislature goes, psh, nope, F you. Sorry, we're not legalizing it. Mm-hmm. I can't fathom how they do that one.
So, well, the adversarial system breaks down if you don't have defense. And eventually the adversarial system is going to break down completely, because everybody doesn't seem to like the adversarial system. It's too inconvenient. Due process is just too expensive, and it takes too much time. So the accusation should be enough. I mean, if someone accuses someone of crime, we should believe them. We should cater to them, and we should tell the person that was accused, sorry, we've got all we need right here.
Doesn't them defunding this to some degree violate people's Sixth Amendment? Is that the one that you have a right to counsel?
Well, it does, but that's never been fully funded anyway. The all states struggle with adequate indigent defense. I don't know a state that anybody can cite to where they do a spectacular, superb job.
Fair, I guess. Some do better than others.
Some do better than others.
But I would suspect that Georgia's not one of the better than others.
It depends on county to county. Still, there's okay. These disparities in counties here where some counties are more generous than others. But I think that was the idea of them creating the state system some years ago, because there was such a disparity between the counties that said it's kind of like indigent burials. You got counties that'll give $300 for an indigent burial in the state. You got counties that'll give a couple $1,000. For an indigent, I think Fulton is one of the most generous counties, and then you've got counties where the undertaker has to do it and take a loss on it because they pay them $200 or $300.
All right, I think we're going to drop this article, the one about Kik. Did you want to drop it, or did you want to cover it real quick?
I don't know anything about it, but I can talk about it if you lead the way.
I'm not sure if it'll make it off the cutting room floor, but there's a messaging app called Kik, K-I-K, sorry. And they've been in business for about 9 years, and they're shutting down to focus on a cryptocurrency scheme that they've got going. But there's a whole bunch of controversy surrounding the app, because it's already mostly anonymous. Like, you don't have to use your phone number to create an account with this thing. And that has then led people to do nefarious things with it to any sort of child exploitation, anything that would be, you know, an online crime like that. And so I think the from that side of things, it's a good thing, I guess. I just don't see how, like, this app being the target for that kind of scrutiny, being challenged as like, hey, this is the tool that people use. You could use a pencil to commit murder, so we should ban all pencils. But so this app is shutting down after 9 years so they can focus on cryptocurrency.
Well, wasn't there a high profile case just recently associated with it where a girl was lured?
Yeah, I mean, but I don't think that's the reason why. Again, how do you convict the communication platform for being, I mean, yes, they facilitated, but do you accuse the post office of mailing the bombs around or the, I guess it was bombs, but there was a white powder substance, during the Obama administration, I guess it was. Maybe it was even during Trump, that stuff. People mail stuff. So then is the post office guilty of doing it?
Well, I don't know that we would say the post office would be guilty of doing it. I guess the question would be, can the post office at a reasonable cost, and that's always the battle of what's reasonable, at a reasonable cost detect unsafe packages and parcels that are moving through their network to prevent them from reaching their destination? That's the question. Well, that's the same thing with Kik. Is there a reasonable precaution that could be taken that would not unduly burden the company and unduly interfere with people who want to communicate by that platform so you could not have these things be as likely to happen? I think that's the question, not would you want to shut it down altogether, but what could you do to be a responsible corporate citizen? And I guess they've decided they could be a responsible corporate citizen by shutting down.
I guess so. They're Canadian based and they were once valued at $1 billion. And I don't know. I only used it briefly and I got scolded by my handlers. They saw that I had installed it. And I don't know. I installed it. I used it a couple times and I installed it, but it showed up in my history. So they were like, oh, you have this app. I was like, I don't have it, but it showed up. Anyway, they were upset with me for having it.
So, well, I've heard that. I've never gone to the, I guess I couldn't after shut down, but I never looked it up, but I heard people from time to time mention Kik. So I had heard of it, but I didn't know anything more than that. So you didn't have to connect it to a phone.
It is an app and it's on your phone, but you don't use your phone number too. So that keeps you anonymous from that point of view. And that's why a lot of people would use it, is on almost everything else, Facebook, anything else, even the privacy focused messenger app called Signal. That's a highly encrypted. They authenticate you using your phone number. It makes it less than anonymous by having to use your phone number to authenticate against it.
Oh, well, alrighty, if you say so.
I do. And I'm the final arbiter of things being said. This next article comes from rrstar.com, which I have no idea what RR, but Rockford is, it's 62 degrees in Rockford right now. But the title of the article is Fantasy Sports and Sex Offender Internet Access on State Supreme Court Docket. This is coming from Illinois. And there's two cases, both of them internet related. One of them is just about betting online and how do you like get your wager money back. The second one is a social media ban. Where do you want to go first?
I don't know anything about either one.
I did reading through it. I don't particularly care about the online betting thing. Go ahead, bet, have fun. They're legalizing it all over the place. So get your rocks off doing that. The other one is a social media ban that sex offenders can't use social media. And this one, there's a couple points that I think to me are of interest. And it says in court documents, the plaintiff called barring access to the internet draconian. And, but then there's another statement in there, and this is, I can channel my inner Larry if I say it, but it says, if you're on supervision, you have a diminished expectation of liberty.
That is correct.
But then I guess, you know, the Packingham stuff, it was people post that they couldn't use social media, and that's where that got struck down. And this is, you know, it's going to get rehashed, I guess, from their point of view. But one other thing that it says, it is almost impossible to that in today's world that you could live without access to social media. Define what social media would be. So we're reading this article, and at the bottom of it, it says, hey, would you like to comment? Doesn't that make it social media? And we're at a news website.
Well, it depends on how they define it in the states where they've tried to do social media restrictions and bans. It depends on how broadly. And in the case of Louisiana, it was so broadly that even the courts there said no way.
So I let me channel my inner Larry. You are a person, right? This is a media publication, right?
Right.
You are being social, right?
Right.
So then this is social media using this this website. But I think you would then find a lot of problems from people. They would push back and go, well, you can't ban somebody from reading the news. Could you?
Well, they can read it in the old-fashioned paper.
That might not be possible. You might then be limited on the publications that you can get. You know, can you go to your library and get it? Oh, wait, many of our people can't go to libraries, right?
Well, that is one of the tests, is there adequate alternatives. So
these things drive me crazy. I, you know, again, back to my stupid pencil example, the internet is just a tool that people use to do things. You can do wonderful things. You can do nefarious things. If you want someone to be monitored, monitor them. And I'm deeply troubled by them restricting access to the internet. This one showed up, and again, it's another article that we don't have enough, but we're going to just try and bat it around for a minute. This is the irishpost.com, and 5-year-old boy with autism labeled sex offender after hugging a classmate. How do you take a kid that has a diminished capacity and does something that he thinks is appropriate? Doesn't seem that he did anything really that horrible, but you label him a sexual predator? That's terrible. Terrible.
Well, and of course, I'm not clear on this. If when they say labeled a sexual predator, who made the label? Is this the result of a criminal proceeding, or is this the school saying that he's internally that they've described him? Who has bestowed that label on him?
The family claimed that Nathan is being accused of sexual activities by members of staff at the school. That's in the second paragraph of the article. So the staff at the school is saying that this kid is a terrible, horrible human. At 9, with autism.
The staff is saying that, but that doesn't make someone a sexual predator. Internally, the school says that they're providing special monitoring of this individual. That doesn't translate to being a sexual predator as far as the world is concerned. So I'm just a little confused about who's labeled him a sexual predator? It sounds like the school has. Doesn't sound like he's been through a court of law and that they've determined he's a sexual predator.
Brenda says it seems that the school system said something, maybe even from the family, saying they feel like he's labeled.
Okay, well, I would feel the same way. But that's an example of how our zero tolerance policy has developed. Stuff is handled by schools entirely differently than what it would have been. It looks like they did call the guardian and say that they were concerned, but things are not handled the same way they used to be handled because of the public sensitivity that we have today. And this is not me saying I support this for those who magically translate when I say something. I'm just reflecting public opinion, not creating it. The public has demanded that schools respond very sternly, very promptly, very aggressively to sexual inappropriate behavior, regardless of the age. What would have been handled in my generation one way is that's not an acceptable method as far as how the public sees how serious these situations are by today's standards.
Yeah. What do you do with a 5-year-old, though? What are you going to do? Run him up the flagpole and label him as a sex offender forever?
Well, I don't know how much information we have about this. It seems like they're providing him more oversight and more scrutiny to his behavior. But if you've got an autistic child, they're not going to be able to conform their behavior. Depending on the severity of the autism, they're not going to be able to conform their behavior.
Yeah, I think society then conforms around them, depending on the severity of the autism.
So, but what would be the alternative would be that we would no longer try to mainstream these kids, and we would try to put, I mean, that's what we've been doing for the last 30 years is trying to mainstream kids rather than separate. In my generation, a kid like this wouldn't even have been in regular school.
Right. But then you end up with all kinds of equality claims and challenges to that the kid deserves a traditional, quote unquote, normal education.
Yeah, that's the point I'm making. Yeah. As we strive to mainstream these kids, some of them will have behavioral problems, and particularly when they have a degree of autism, they're not able. I had a sister that was institutionalized, died a few years ago, but she was institutionalized in a Georgia institution with autism for almost her entire life until they closed the institution.
Well, let's move over to the Altoona Mirror, and this title is Inmate Loses Court Challenge, Hesley Contested Sexual Violent Predator Finding. And where is this? I guess Altoona's Pennsylvania. And a Bedford County man who entered a no-contest plea in 2010 to the rape of a child has lost his challenge to a court finding that he was a sexually violent predator, which means he must register as a sex offender. Why do you think that this is an important article to cover, Larry?
Well, I don't know if I put it in here, but for the people who have thirst for legal knowledge and who enjoy the nuances, this case is very challenging for that type of mindset, because in Pennsylvania you don't become a sexually violent predator by crime. You become a sexually violent predator by a proceeding that people go through. And so at the end of your trial, if you take it to trial or after you plea, the Commonwealth asks that you be designated as a sexually violent predator. Now, that was under their previous Megan's Law. They don't have Megan's Law anymore. They adopted the Adam Walsh Act, which became effective in 2012, their version of the Adam Walsh Act. And they went purely to an offense-based system. And that designation no longer existed. Well, then all these court challenges resulted in new problems for people, for the Commonwealth, because the retroactive application of the Adam Walsh Act was declared invalid by the courts. There was two cases, Munez, and I forget the name of the other one, may have been Tucker or something, but there was two cases.
Butler.
Well, I was close.
Yep.
And we talked a lot about the Munez decision at NARSL on various conference calls. And so the people that were under the Megan's Law designation as a sexually violent predator, they end up with a designation that they can't challenge, because you had 1 year from when your sentence became final to challenge that determination. Well, then, unless you had a crystal ball, you didn't know that the new version of registration was going to be declared unconstitutional. So these people are arguing that they should be able to go back and challenge outside the one-year window, they're a sexually violent predator is designation, and the court saying not until we're told by an appellate level court that the Munez and the Butler decision is retroactive. They're not retroactive, so you still don't have a vehicle to use. You're time barred. So that's why it's interesting to me if they're going to be able to lift that time bar. And I know someone on a personal level that has that designation, and it's tragic because that was who he might have been decades ago, but that's not who he is today.
Gotcha.
But there's nothing he can do about it because the door is closed.
Okay. Man. So that's almost like a statute of limitations, right?
Well, it's a time bar for making a challenge to the SVP designation. And so they're trying to establish that the appellate level decisions of Munez and Butler should open the door to a belated challenge, and I hope they win.
I do too. We are very time constrained, so let's cover these last couple articles quickly. We have a New York Times opinion piece that says how mandatory minimums enable police misconduct. Didn't we just like reference some stuff about this in one of the previous articles? It sounded familiar.
Yeah, these tie together. A lot of misconduct by the police can be covered up by mandatory minimums because the prosecutor looks at that and says, oh, well, this doesn't look like a very credible uh, this affidavit just isn't credible. So this works to illustrate what we were talking about earlier. If a prosecutor is reviewing affidavits and evidence, and they are dumbfounded because they know that something couldn't have happened the way that it's written down by the officer, then they have the opportunity to extract a plea anyway because there's a mandatory minimum in play. So a defendant can move to suppress evidence, and the prosecutor can say, well, I'll give you a sweetheart deal if you'll go ahead and take this one-time deal today. I'll give you probation, and we'll look the other way. They don't say that, but what they're saying indirectly is that, well, we're going to look the other way on the misconduct. You get a sweetheart deal, you get a probated sentence, and you go on about your life. Well, they shouldn't have made the stop to begin with. They lied about what the basis for stopping me. Yeah, they did find the note, but they didn't have the basis for the stop. They couldn't have seen what they saw because it was pitch black and the windows were tinted, and they couldn't have seen what they said they saw. So I want the officer to have to testify, and I want to show the video, and I want to show this officer to be a pathological liar. Well, you can do that, but if for some reason you lose the suppression motion, then your probated sentence is off the table, and you're going to get the mandatory minimum if you get convicted. So you'd rather serve 3 years in prison on a mandatory minimum than have a 3 years probated sentence. That's a tough position to put people in.
Agreed.
And that's the one of the downsides of mandatory minimums is because it allows for misconduct to be accepted because you think you're getting a great deal, because the hammer of the mandatory minimum, the judge is not going to be able to give you probation because the legislature has tied his or her hands by saying that this offense against society is so severe that you have to receive this sentence.
This goes back to like the thing that I keep saying, though. It just feels like prosecutors are just totally after the notch in their belt. They're not interested in justice. They're not interested in the civil liberties. They are interested in the victories, only the victories. And this supports that.
Well, they're interested in closing out the case, and they're interested in not destroying the camaraderie of the team they have to work with. How well are they going to work with a police agency if you have prosecutors looking at the police officer and saying, well, I'm sorry, this affidavit is just unbelievable. Yeah, I think you're a joke of a cop.
But that's at the expense of somebody going and sitting in a cage.
That is exactly that. That's at the expense of that. But that doesn't change the reality.
Yeah.
The cop is going to go back and say, you're not going to believe, but Prosecutor Jones just told me that I was a pathological liar, and that she wasn't going to even put on my case, that she was dismissing it and filing another persiki. And can you believe that? And then the officer says, well, I'll declare. Well, we'll just find out about that. And first thing you know, you've got no camaraderie on the team. And that's the problem that they're facing. Again, I don't agree with this, folks. I wish this wasn't the reality of the situation. I am dead set against this. I'm merely telling you, I'm the communication piece telling you why they do it. Because I'm waiting for the deluge of hate mail saying, well, there he's on the prosecution team all of a sudden.
I'm going to forward them all to you, by the way.
But that's what their considerations are. And I can't change their considerations. I don't make the rules for police conduct. I don't form that camaraderie of protection that they have. And I don't make these rules for life. I'm merely telling you that's their consideration.
So not the world the way it should be, but it is be.
That's exactly right.
I gotcha. All right. And then to close it out, and then we have the other New York Times opinion piece. So the police can't solve the problem. They are the problem. 25 years after the infamous 1994 crime bill, too many criminal justice groups are simply reimagining mass incarceration. Good read. And any highlights that you want to cover before we have to scoot out of here?
I like this article because it illustrates what I say. And since I don't have a fancy degree to say it, it has statistics that are in here that are just so remarkable that I would like to highlight them. The crime bill of 1994, which President Clinton signed.
That's the super predator thing, right?
Well, that was among many things that it did, but it, those of you that are too young to remember, or those with faded memories, President Clinton promised that he was going to help local communities have 100,000 new officers on the streets. Now, he was elected in 93, and he left office at the end of 2000, early 2001. But at the time, but between the decade of the 90s, the number of police officers went up dramatically, thanks to a lot of federal funding. And boy, with those local communities who believe that they hate the federal government so much, they were happy to take that money to have those extra police officers. So the legislation was partly responsible for a 30% increase in the number of police officers from 699,000 in 1990 to 899,000 in 1999. So we got 200,000 more cops, 7,000 more police officers into schools, and now today, according to this article, there are over 1 million law enforcement officers in the United States. Now, at the same time, there has been a 26% decline in overall crime from 1993 to 2000. So as crime went down, the number of officers continued to go up. And what I don't understand is, if you continue to increase the number of cops while the number of crimes are going down, how do you provide work for those cops to do?
Oh, I think I know. They trump up bullshit things to do. Like, wow, go around and harass people on Halloween.
Yes. So I continue to say that as crime drops, the number of people in the law enforcement establishment needs to also go down, not up. Down, folks. Down. You won't be able to contain the number of cases that enter the justice system if you don't contain the ability to file cases. So therefore, rather than running down to your city council and to your state legislature demanding more and more cops, you need to run down to your city council and your county commission and to your state legislature demanding fewer and fewer cops, because you're safer now than you've ever been in recorded history. And we were just talking about that. We were watching a TV show, the news show the other night here in this very bunker, about a crime in Covington. And I said, well, this crime would have happened 30 years also ago. The only difference is today we know about it because Covington's a part of the Atlanta metro area. It's accepted now. Back in 30 years ago, you had to make a long distance call from Covington to Atlanta, and you had to pay money to talk from Covington to Atlanta. And if you were going to put something on the news from Covington, you had to dispatch a remote vehicle that cost gobs of money. You had to buy satellite time so you could upload it to your studio, so you could, or you could do a live stand up. You do all that with free technology today. You know, you can be on your phone, doesn't cost anything. You can do a live stand up on location. So what happened in Covington that made the Atlanta news wouldn't have made the Atlanta news 30 years ago. But you're safer now than you were 30 years ago. Statistically, folks, you're safer being alive today than you were 30 years ago. Back to the point of this article, if you want to stop the number of people being brought into the system, you've got to contain and reduce the number of cops. Closing jails is a part of the equation. But if you continue to have the same number of people processing and arresting folks, you're going to have an overcrowded situation with your remaining jails. You have to stop bringing cases into the system. And the cops are not going to file fewer cases. If you double the size of your police department, you're going to have more people arrested. I mean, it's just basic numbers. If a cop's out on patrol, if you have double number of patrol officers, those officers are going to write more citations, and they're going to do more stops. They're going to do more canine searches. They're going to do more things that they wouldn't have been able to do if you didn't have them out there.
Brenda says, we can't have that. We won't be safe.
Oh.
You know, so this goes to, we've had this conversation about, like, there's some sort of implicit rule in Georgia that if you drive 10 over, you won't get pulled over, which I say is complete poppycock. I mean, it may be true until that day where there's an extra cop and they've decided to set the rule today to be 6 miles over, or then another day it's 4 miles over. How do you know that today is the day that it's 10 and that's okay? You just set your cruise on 80 when it's 70. Why is that all of a sudden okay? It does say speed limit. I don't mean to be a pedantic asshole, but, like, is five okay? Is six? Is seven? Where does it cross the line that the cop's going to let you get away with it? And if there's 10 times as many law enforcement out there, that number might become one.
It might become one, or it might become one if you fit a particular profile. And that's what we have the problem with profiling, because as a middle-aged white man driving a very conservative car, they're probably not going to pull me over in most circumstances. I know we had a guy tell me he was in the ghetto in a high crime, drug infested area, and they pulled him over because he was white and he didn't belong there. I've heard that story before. We've had it on the podcast.
Yep.
But by and large, I'm not going to get pulled over no matter where I go. By and large, I'm not going to have a problem. But if you fit one of the profiles, you're going to get pulled over if they're the extra manpower to do that, because that's what cops do. They look for problems. That's how they're able to set up these massive sting undercover operations where they have dozens of officers from multiple agencies chatting online, convincing people that they're 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, and convincing them to drive across the state or across the country. That's how they're able to do that, because you gave them the resources.
Larry, we got to close this thing out. We got to get on the road.
You think so?
I do. So I'm going to say this really quick. Registrymatters.co, 747-227-4477. Registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, as always, the best way to support us is patreon.com/registrymatters. And thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you to all of our listeners. Thank you to the people in chat. And with that, Larry, episode 94 is in the circular file now.
Well, thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye.